This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Israeli and Palestinian negotiations resumed talks this past summer for the first time since 2010, in part because of Israel's release of 104 Palestinian prisoners. Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas told the UN General Assembly last week that he wants a peace deal within 9 months. But these talks won't be easy, and American attention to the issue has taken a backseat to worries over Iran's nuclear program and the ongoing conflict in Syria. But even today on NPR's Morning Edition, a small glimmer of hope, news of Israel easing restrictions on building materials going into Gaza. It's seen as a peaceful gesture in a relationship that still suffers from settlement expansions by Israelis in the West Bank and attacks against Israeli soldiers by Palestinians. How to solve this problem? We're going to be talking with some people who've studied the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, some from the front lines. You can join us 860-275-7266. 860-275-7266 is the number. You can email us where we live at WNPR.org, or you can tweet us at where we live. Joining us by phone first is Dr. Jeremy Pressman, who's Associate Professor of Political Science and Director of Middle East Studies at the University of Connecticut. Dr. Pressman, welcome to our show.
Thank you, John.
I'm wondering if first you can outline what's driving these peace talks that started this summer and where you believe they are right now.
Well, the United States made a decision that for U.S. national interests, it was very important to get talks restarted to try and increase some stability in the Middle East. As we know, Secretary of State John Kerry poured a tremendous amount of effort into getting the talks restarted, talks that really almost no one thought he would be successful in restarting. So I think, you know, the U.S. gets some credit for that. In terms of what the talks have done over the last couple months, we don't know a lot. They have emphasized, I think, even more than usual secrecy, because they have felt in the past that leaks and too much public discussion have undermined the ability to press the parties for concessions. So I think that we don't know a lot. We know that they're working on several tracks, on diplomatic issues, on security issues. General John Allen is in the region to deal particularly with Israeli security concerns. They're working on economic issues. But in terms of, you know, more details than that, as Martin Indyk, the special envoy, emphasized the other day at J Street, it's really about secrecy. And if he, you know, he doesn't have the authority to tell us yet what's really going on.
When we hear that President Abbas wants some sort of resolution in 9 months, it seems a very aggressive time frame, given the fact that right now Secretary of State Kerry is in the Far East, in Asia, working on behalf of President Obama. The fact that the United States has a domestic political crisis at hand right now, and that when we talk about foreign policy, it seems to be about Syria and the conflict there, or about Iran and its nuclear weapons, or our relationship with Russia. Do you hold out any hope that these peace negotiations are going to get moving anytime soon?
For sure, there's a lot else going on, and we don't even have to look to Asia. If you just look in the region, in Syria, in Egypt, in Iran, it's greatly overshadowed the Israeli-Palestinian talks. President Abbas really emphasizes the time frame, because what he's trying to avoid is a process without peace. Certainly, the Palestinian Authority leaders, President Abbas, his top negotiator, Saeb Erekat, what they're concerned about is that the Netanyahu government just wants to engage in talks because Israel feels it has to do that to please the United States, but doesn't actually want to make any substantive concessions. So I think that the reason for that Abbas is constantly emphasizing the time frame is to try and sort of box the Israelis into a corner to force them to make some decisions. Is it plausible in 9 months that we could have an agreement? Sure. There's enough details, there's enough knowledge about what has to happen on the core issues of Jerusalem and refugees. It's more a question of political will. Do the parties want that agreement within 9 months? It's not a question of whether they could negotiate it and whether they know what the details would look like.
Do you think the parties want an agreement within 9 months, truly?
Well, I think President Abbas does. The Palestinian side is clearly split, but the main opponents of the agreement are outside the Palestinian government. It's Hamas. Whereas on the Israeli side, it's almost a more interesting political dynamic. You have both great supporters and great opponents of a two-state solution who are within the Israeli coalition government. So it's a little more of a crapshoot about whether or not right now this Israeli government is willing to support it. Netanyahu said, and he said again at the UN this week, that he is ready to make painful concessions, as he phrased it. But we'll see whether the composition of his government would support those painful concessions.
We're talking today about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and peace talks as well in the program. If you want to join us, 860-275-7266. Dr. Jeremy Pressman joins us by phone today. He's from the University of Connecticut. He's a professor of political science and director of Middle East studies. Hang on for one second, Doctor, while I welcome in some of our guests who are here as part of a program called Combatants for Peace. They're in town for a series of events. They're actually doing a lunch talk today at the Hartford Seminary here in Hartford. It's at noontime. More information at hartsem.edu. There's also an I Wage Peace Walk coming up this Sunday, October 6th, 2 p.m. on the Lower Green in downtown New Haven. There's more information at iwagepeace.org. We'll find out more about I Wage Peace coming up in just a bit, but I want to welcome in two folks who are part of Combatants for Peace, Mohammed Oueda, who grew up near the Western Wall in Jerusalem, also works for this organization. Mohammed, welcome to our show.
Thank you so much.
And Erez Crispin is a former captain in the Israeli Army in charge of foreign affairs for Combatants of Peace. Welcome to you, sir.
Thank you.
I'll ask you first, and then I'll ask you to weigh in as well. Just starting this conversation with Dr. Pressman, we want to get a sense of how you feel the possibility for peace talks might be going this time versus the many other times we've heard this, we've had American intervention, and we've started down this path. Are you hopeful?
Unfortunately, I'm not hopeful. I agree with the doctor. We think, and this is part of our message of with which we are coming to the U.S., without the unfolding pressure of the U.S. on both sides, especially on the Israeli side, to reach an agreement, we believe that nothing will happen. We believe in Tzipi Livni and in her good faith, but we don't believe in the good faith of her boss, Bibi Netanyahu. He's, at the end of the day, is a right-wing hardliner. His coalition partners, most of them are hardliners, and we don't see him taking the risk, the necessary risk, in order to pass such an agreement. If you look at the past, you see that whenever the U.S. was strong in its pressure on the two sides, like, for example, in the 1977 and later the Camp David with Egypt, there was an agreement. In 2000, Barack and Arafat met in Camp David. U.S. decided not to put pressure, and the results were a second intifada. That's what we believe that will happen if the two parties will not reach agreement this time.
When you say necessary risk, tell me what that necessary risk is, because politicians of all stripes in all countries try to avoid risk when possible. What do you mean when you say risk?
It's exactly what you refer to. There is a certain risk, a political risk, of survival in Israel when you try to pass such an agreement, because the main supporters of Netanyahu right now are right-wing, including settlers. And by doing this move, he might lose part of his constituents. We think that he will win, the centrists, but we don't think that in the eyes of Netanyahu, he will take this chance and, switch to other constituents within the Israeli camp.
Sir, give me your thoughts. Are you hopeful about this round of peace talks?
Two things. First of all, you spoke about the 9 months. First of all, it's the idea of United States. 9 months, the first one that he said is was John Kerry. I hope that I will make the agreement in 9 months. And also we are, like a Palestinian, yes, we are with 9 months, or 9 months, but also we hope after, if it's failed after 9 months, that the American will push it more further to be agreement. Not like Eric said, like Camp David to leave us and say, go in your way. Hope, there's no hope in the Palestinian side, because if you're seeing, we are going to negotiate about the two states, and I'm hearing this from the Israeli side, but I never hear it on border 67, and East Jerusalem is the capital. So if you can hear it two states, you can hear it from everyone. Even Netanyahu can say, even the right wing, if he will say it for you, right wing, and he will say two states, nobody say for what. The third thing is no hope, because we're seeing that the Israeli side is still building settlement and taking lands after land. So which agreement they are speaking about? If they want to leave, and you said painful ways that we will make, what's painful, Yani? We don't ask no Haifa, no Yaffa, no Tel Aviv, nothing. We're asking about our lands and our villages. But if they are still in the middle of negotiation, they're still taking them. So we're sure that the way is so long until the agreement.
Dr. Pressman, I think two things that Mohammed just said there are things that we want to pick up on. First, maybe pull apart the idea of what you believe a two-state solution is. When we hear about a two-state solution, what do you think that means perhaps to America? What does that mean to the Palestinians? What does it mean to the Israelis?
Well, I think it's absolutely true that it means different things to different people. It does mean two sovereign entities. It means that the Gaza Strip and the vast majority of the West Bank would constitute the state of Palestine. But then you have to actually delineate the border, and on that question, it gets difficult. You have to actually talk about what it means to have the Israeli capital in West Jerusalem and the Palestinian capital in most of East Jerusalem, except areas where Israel has built neighborhoods or settlements in East Jerusalem. So it's a very tricky dynamic, but it does mean some kind of division of Jerusalem in terms of sovereignty, even though you try and keep it as a united open city. It means addressing the refugee question, and here there remains very different perspectives. The Palestinian leadership in the past has sometimes indicated that they, as long as Israel agreed to the right of return or something like that in theory, that in implementation that right could be severely limited and really financial compensation could take place instead. Whether at the end of the day that would be an agreement, it's still open to question. So I think we're close, but there's still important things. What would happen in Jerusalem, what the exact implementation of the Palestinian refugee question would look like, what one would do with the old city in Jerusalem and the holy sites in Jerusalem, is also tricky. So it means a division, but exactly where the lines are and how you implement each aspect of it is an important point. The one other thing I'd say is that, as I mentioned, General John Allen is in the region working on security, and a lot of that, Israel has long emphasized security as sort of a prerequisite to make any kind of deal, and trying to work out both the security that would take place between Israelis and Palestinians, and also what role the United States might play to reassure Israel if it took this kind of chance, is also an important dynamic.
And this idea of what the American involvement is something I'd like you to talk about for just a moment before we let you go, sir. We've heard some different reports about whether Secretary Kerry is indeed talking about negotiating around the, as Mohammed said earlier, the 1967 borders. I believe that maybe some of the Palestinian faction believe that he has indeed even said that that's where negotiations are going to start. Others, of course, believe that there's no way that negotiations could ever start there. Do you think that the way the United States has handled this so far in the way they've been trying to mediate, do you think that it's been effective?
I think the United States has done an excellent job. As I said earlier, Secretary Kerry gets a lot of credit for restarting the talks at a time when no one or almost no one believed that he could restart the talks. He's done an excellent job as a convener, and I think he's done an excellent job as a cheerleader, trying to reframe our understanding of, okay, we can be pessimists, there's many people who think it's impossible, but can there be a few optimists who don't think this is likely, but at least think there's a slight possibility that a deal could happen. That said, there's going to come a time, and it's going to come soon, when the U.S. position either has to transition or this could all fall apart. You can be a convener and a cheerleader at the beginning, but that you can't go the whole way simply in that role. At some point, the United States is going to have to take a more intensive mediating role, and if it's unwilling to do that, if President Obama at the end of the day either doesn't have or is unwilling to spend the political capital to really get ultimately himself, but also his administration, more deeply involved in resolving these very difficult core issues, then I think being a convener and being a cheerleader isn't going to get you get far enough. It can get you started, but it can't get you to the finish line.
Mohammed, I know that Erez talked earlier about the fact that there are different political factions within Israel that maybe want to do different things. There are clearly different political factions amongst the Palestinians as well. I guess I'm wondering if you can talk about the role of Hamas in this. The fact is that Hamas is very important in many ways to the people of Gaza. Hamas is also seen by the United States and its allies as a terrorist organization. I'm wondering if you can talk about what Hamas means and how much influence you think it may have in this process.
Okay. I think that Israel and also the Palestinian Authority had separated Hamas from the West Bank. Because of this, you're seeing that Hamas is in the Gaza and the Palestinian Authority in the West Bank. A lot of people saying, okay, so the agreement will be with the West Bank, not with Gaza. And I am always saying that it's the same people. They are brothers. Palestinian from the post side, even if it's Hamas or it's in Fatah or even any group. I saw before less than half year there was demonstration for Fatah in Gaza, and it was more than 1 million people in the street. It's meaning that all of Gaza is from Hamas. Just we will say that the people that catching the authority there is from Hamas. In the another side, yes, the agreement will be in the West Bank in the beginning. Of course, it will be in the West Bank, not in all Palestine, like West Bank and Gaza. Fluence of Hamas, there will be nothing like this in the West Bank. But from the another thing, like I always saying that if they are the same and they will see freedom in the Gaza, they will see the freedom in the West Bank, and they will say the education, and they will saying the good economic, and they will saying that the liberty that they having, and they will saying that they having their state. I think it's the same. They will feel jealous and want to be like them. And the Arabic Spring, it will be in Egypt, and also it can be in Gaza. But if it will be the same under occupation for the post side, humiliated from the post side, I think that Gaza will say, okay, if it's the same, so we will be in status quo, like in the same time.
I mentioned earlier that there was a story on Morning Edition from NPR today about a small effort to open up some supply lines so that more concrete and building materials could get from Israel into Gaza. During that story, Gazan novelist and political science professor Atef Abu Saif talked about working with Hamas. And let's just listen to a bit of what he said.
Their practice and their behavior and their political translations of their ideas are extremely bad. But they will always find supporters, unfortunately. You have to think how to include them and to affect the way they behave.
And that's for Morning Edition. Again, I'm wondering, Eos, if maybe you can pick up on this. The fact that this one faction indeed, it does have so many supporters. As Mohammed says, not all of the supporters in Gaza, but certainly many, many supporters in that region, and that it is clearly in conflict with Israel in a different way than the Palestinian Authority. Maybe you can talk about Hamas and how you think they might be, I don't know, used in this process in a way to help bring the peace that you're looking for.
Look, there are radicals on both sides. We have the radicals, the Palestinians have their radicals. And both radicals were used by the governments in order not to reach an agreement. We know that this enclave in Gaza was actually built by the Israeli government in order to have two different entities controlling the Palestinians. I think that it is marginal. Those leaders will have to cope with the radicals, maybe even strongly. On our side, there are these settlers, the hardliners. You know, we didn't talk about this, but everything starts and ends with the evacuation, the necessity to evacuate settlements. We're talking about from 70,000 settlers to 100,000 settlers, given the one-to-one land swaps. They will also reject, they will also maybe resort to violence. I think that this is what I meant before, that the leaders should be brave. The leaders should be prepared to make concessions, to make even political concessions. We always say that in order to stay in history, you can either be in history or be a history. Mm. And I think both Abu Mazen and Netanyahu will have to decide now, because the window of opportunity for the two-state solution is closing up. As Muhammad said before, settlements are built right now, expanded right now, new outposts are created right now. We will reach a certain point in which the two-state solution will not be possible. There will be too many settlers that you have to evacuate. Nobody will take this political risk. And then violence will erupt. And I don't want even to dream about what will happen in our region.
And, of course, Abu Mazen, he refers to as President Abbas. Jeremy Pressman, what do you make in the last minute that we have? What do you make of the fact that as we engage in these peace talks that, again, you say we're hard worked on by Secretary of State Kerry and perhaps may do something good here, that during this time, the settlements continue in the West Bank. There are still these things going on that seemingly have been the impediments to the very process that we're talking about here.
going on the ground that aren't conducive to peace. That's absolutely true. And the United States has made a decision over the last few decades that it's not going to take on settlements directly. In the few moments, as we've seen, when presidents have tried to do that, whether it was President Carter at the Camp David summit in 1978 or whether it was President Obama in his first term, when they've tried to take on settlements outside the context of a larger peace process, they've largely failed when they've tried to do a settlement freeze. So we've seen them try that, and it hasn't worked. But generally, the United States has stepped back from that and said, we have to resolve the whole situation. Look, there's no reason to be wildly optimistic. There's lots of reasons why this could all fall apart. But I do think it's fair to say, even more than the reality on the ground, the last gasp here is that we've tried this for 20 years. And I think if this effort fails, it's almost more than the facts on the ground. It's a political process. The political idea of trying a two-state solution will have run its course. And the appeal of other options to people, I think, will grow because they'll just say, we've tried this again and again and again, and it hasn't worked.
Jeremy Pressman is a professor at the University of Connecticut. He's director of Middle East Studies there. Thank you so much for joining us, sir. I appreciate it.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Now, when we come back, we're going to continue our conversation with Combatants for Peace, who are here in Connecticut for a series of events, and we'll talk with them about their own personal stories on both sides of this conflict. And we'll also take your calls at 860-275-7266. This is Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankowski. We're talking today about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and some of the recent events that are affecting peace negotiations there. You can join us at 860-275-7266. Email wherewelive at WNPR.org or tweet us at Where We Live. We have people here from Combatants for Peace, a program which we'll be talking a bit more about and getting some of their personal stories. But I do want to get to Rosette, who's calling from Milford. Hello, Rosette. You're on Where We Live.
Hi. I wanted to just comment, if I may, on this enormously important subject. As a teacher, I feel that the only way for peace to be meaningful and lasting and significant is if children are taught, to have new cultural norms that they are taught instead of biases. So that particularly on the Palestinian side, where you have books, geography books, that show maps of Israel, and it's called Palestine, where Jews are called the offsprings of pigs and monkeys, where suicide bombers are celebrated in the streets, and streets are named after them, and little children are educated and encouraged to write poetry about becoming a suicide bomber. This is a disaster. Peace should come. This is crucial for both peoples, but it has to come meaningfully, and it has to come start in the schools.
Well, Rosette, thank you so much for your phone call. And let me turn to Erez Crispin, who's former captain in the Israeli army, to talk a bit about this. Please, what do you say to Rosette?
Okay, Rosette, first I agree with you. Everybody agrees with you. But one comment, the other side is dehumanized equally on the Israeli side. If you enter schools in Israel, you will see maps that Palestine is portrayed as part of Israel. Our media dehumanizes them. It's responsibility of both sides. There is some view, especially among, I think, Americans here, that it's only the Palestinians that are dehumanizing and having stereotypes about Israel. It's equally on both sides and a responsibility of both sides, although, by the way, that both sides are not equal. You know, there is the oppressor and the oppressed, and it's natural that sometimes the oppressed may have more resentments against the other party. In addition, there is a survey and actually a research that was conducted here in New Haven, I think in Yale. I'm sure Bruce can talk about this a little bit more, that shows that actually the textbooks on both sides are less offending, are less dehumanizing than we thought before.
Maybe I can bring in Bruce Barrett, who's activist and founder of iwagepeace.org. They're pulling together this series of events that we're talking about here today with the Combatants for Peace. Bruce, welcome to our show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Maybe you can address what Erez was just talking about.
Yeah, regarding school textbooks, at the Yale School of Medicine, School of Psychiatry, Dr. Bruce Wexler conducted a study. There was a $500,000 grant that Dr. Wexler received from the State Department. He brought in the rabbinic in Israel, the Department of Education, Ministry of Education from both sides, the Palestinian Authority, and they studied textbooks. The study was released in February of this year. And they specifically wanted to address this issue of the demonization in textbooks. Is it really happening or is it myth? And what Dr. Wexler concluded, without a doubt, is that neither side in their textbooks is demonizing the other side. It's very rare that textbooks in Israel or in Palestine are Jew-baiting or Muslim-baiting or attacking. What he did find, however, very significantly, is that neither side humanizes or even mentions the other side. Textbooks in both the Palestinian Authority and in Israel don't show maps showing the other people. There's no cultural exchange. There's no discussion of what Palestinians are like, how they live, where they are, the history of the conflict. There's no study of Israel's relationship to them or what Israelis do, what their daily life is like, how they came from. And this absence, concluded Dr. Wexler in his study, allows for a myth of dehumanization. And it's very painful and very difficult. And peace is not possible unless you can humanize and understand the other.
Well, Erez, perhaps you can talk a bit more about how you grew up. You grew up in a more conservative family. And certainly you may have heard some things from people over the years that would lead you to have developed a certain relationship toward thoughts about Palestinians. What was that like?
Right. I grew up in a family with political opinions leaning towards the right. And so during my childhood, I truly believe that, you know, all Palestinians are terrorists or potential terrorists, that they didn't want peace with us. And if they said that they wanted peace with us, it was just a rhetoric, a false rhetoric. And I really thought, based on my family and traumatic fears from, you know, hijacks and hostage crises during my childhood, I really believe that in order to survive, we had to be strong and aggressive in terms of military force. This was my starting point, and it's the starting point, actually, of many Israelis, many Israeli children, even today.
Adi Greenfield also joins us today. Thank you so much for being here. I know you wanted to jump into this conversation.
You talked about Elaz and his background growing up in Israel in a somewhat right-leaning family. Well, I actually grew up in a very, very liberal home with a father that used to go to demonstration, put bumper stickers on our car. We were very left, very pro-peace, and even I grew up with same education, I mean basic Israeli education system, and I had never met a Palestinian, had never known what the situation was in the West Bank or in Gaza. No one has ever taught me that. I never learned to use the word Palestinian or know what Palestinian means until I was probably well after my army service. All I knew was that there were Arabs. The discourse in the Israeli school system, I think, doesn't focus very much, at least when I grew up. Even in history class, we don't talk so much about the wars. We do know there is some notion of Arabs and conflict, but not specifically. I've never learned about Israel's responsibility for the situation, the political situation in the area. I mean, regarding the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, until I started learning it for myself, and that was well into my university years.
But it speaks to this idea, as we were talking earlier, about whether or not anyone is hopeful for this latest round of peace negotiations, for instance, because we've heard many times the efforts at peace negotiations led by Americans, and then they fall apart and we don't get very far. What you're saying is that even those Israelis who are most predisposed by the way they're growing up to understand this really don't understand the plight of the other. They really don't get anything about Palestinians. Frankly, Adi, how indeed do you get at peace if no one really understands what the other side is all about anyway? Who the people we're fighting are? How do we get there?
That's a very good question. That's obviously something that we're struggling with as well. But at the end of the day, I mean, there are groups like us, and you refer to it as I don't remember the exact term that you used, but a program. We're not a program. We're a movement. We're a grassroots movement, a binational movement, Israeli and Palestinian, formed by former combatants on both sides. So these are people who have taken an active part, to different extents, but an active part in the cycle of violence. And those are the people who were dehumanizing the other side for years. And we're doing a lot of work both in Israeli community and in the Palestinian community to sort of work towards humanizing the other side. Of course, we're a small group. We're doing the best that we can. And there are other programs, not activists as we are the only binational Israeli-Palestinian activist peace movement. But there are other programs working with dialogue, trying to get that. But I think as I don't know if I want to say pessimistic, but as realistic as we are looking onto it, we're also realistic enough to understand that there is no choice. This has to, an agreement has to be reached. So that's where the optimism comes from.
Just to add a small thing to what Adi said, we found out that the magic lies in the encounter. If you put the two sides together for the first time, you know, most Israelis never met a Palestinian, not through a gun sight, and most Palestinians didn't meet an Israeli, not in jail. So just taking the two and put them together, and then this magic of all the dehumanization and demonization and stereotypes, they just collapse. And this is one of our objectives, one of our goals in our activity.
In some ways, on our program, we talk an awful lot, obviously, because we're a radio program and we talk to people. We talk a lot about language and what it means. And even the idea of combatants for peace as a movement is interesting because let's take apart the word combatants. On one side, you have people who've served in the Israeli military. Mm-hmm. People who are on the other side are never referred to as being part of a military group, as part of an army. They are militants. They are sometimes thought of as terrorists. They are infidel. There's a number of different words that are used, but it's never seemingly equal. Do you think that matters in this conversation, that indeed we have unequal weighting on the way the Israeli combatants and the Palestinian combatants are considered by the world?
Absolutely. You know, they tend, and Muhammad can say a lot about this, someone who is not with uniforms, that does not belong to an organized army of an organized state that we didn't allow them to have, suddenly is a terrorist. We always say that someone who is a terrorist for one is a freedom fighter for the other. And this is our philosophy. There are combatants on both sides. We don't regard the uniforms and the organized army as important. Most of the people in our region and throughout the world do regard this as an important issue of classifying people in terms of violent actions.
Mohammed, I'd love to hear your thoughts on this.
Yes, it's exactly. When you're speaking about the two sides, they will say for you past terrorist and that Israelian who were in the army, and you will not hear fighters, or you will not hear freedom resistant. The most word that you have, you prisoners, mm-hmm. past prisoners or past terrorists. And what I want to say, always I am saying for the Israeli side, when the Israeli side was fighting against the British, it was freedom fighters, and they make for them statues. And when we are freedom fighters, we are terrorists. And we are not equal, even by the name. But when you are making like this activist organization and you meet them and you work together by activists, not dialogue, you found like you are the same. And the difference between us is just one word. Narrative. What you're seeing from that side, it's not what you're seeing from my side. For me, in their eyes, the terrorist is in my eyes, my leaders. And for them, who's their leaders in the army, for my side is a terrorist. So the between us is just one mirror from two sides, and one word is narrative.
Maybe you can talk about what you heard growing up. We heard from Adi and from Erez about the words that they heard growing up about how they didn't really ever encounter Palestinians in daily life. What did you hear about Israelis?
I want to answer because of this. I want to answer about the woman that she said.
Yes, our earlier caller. Yes.
Yes. First of all, in the map, I'm totally agree that in our map you've seen just Palestine, but all the words that she said, monkeys and pommers and. If it was, I don't know from where they bringing this words and or this knowledge, because I want to say for her, believe me, if it was true, he was founding Netanyahu with this box in the middle of the United Nations showing the people who we are. So let's. I agree that in our maps we think Palestine. Totally, I agree. You will not found anywhere Israel, and totally I agree. But to go like this right wing, that's monkeys and killers, and believe me, the Israeli side was using this before you even you know.
Let's go to Jay, who's calling from Shelton, and yes. You can join us at 860-275-7266. Hello, Jay. You're on Where We Live.
Hi, John. Thanks for taking my call.
Yes.
I would love to understand, to what degree do religious differences play a part in the inability of the two sides to settle their differences? I'll take my answer off the air. Thanks.
Jay, thank you very much for that. I may just ask you, Bruce Barrett, to just start, and maybe we'll go around the table and talk about this. It's a good question.
Sure. That's a wonderful question. You know, I can speak in terms of my family here, of Muslim Christians and Jews. Too often we think of this, I think, as a religious conflict. And what I've learned from the combatants and visiting, that it's not a religious conflict. It's a conflict about land. It's a conflict about real estate, politics, people looking for their terra firma. And it's also a human rights conflict. It's about equality and civil rights. Each side then brings their religious faith into the conflict to help them explain how they should act or not act. And all of our faith traditions have tremendous histories of nonviolent action and of peacemaking. The Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, was first and foremost a peacemaker uniting tribes. Jesus was a peacemaker. And Moses and the laws and the history of the Jewish people, it's about peacemaking. It's about learning how to work together. So I believe our religious communities can be solutions and motivate, inspire us here and there. But we have to remember how to do that and not think that the problem is essentially religious. The problem is about real estate. It's about politics, human rights, civil rights, and security, of course, and security and safety and fear.
I'm wondering, would you like to comment on this idea of what role religion plays?
I think, as Bruce said, that religion, although portrayed as the front, is not really the cause. The real cause is deep-rooted fears on both sides and mistrust. They are, they stem from the Holocaust, they stem from what happened in Israel, they stem of what happened in Palestine to the Palestinians. And if we don't address these deep-rooted fears with understanding and not animosity, if we just focus on religion, then we will not be able to solve the problem. What will happen? They will reach an agreement, but it will be like a ceasefire, because if the arts are not transformed, it will be a ceasefire. There will be some a settlement between the two parties. In order to have peace, coexistence, we must work on the deep-rooted fears and to address them and to, solve them.
Mohammed?
I disagree a little bit, because I think that the religion in the middle of the conflict, because if we're speaking about the settlers and the settlement that it's falling the West Bank, they don't live there because the view is so nice. And the hills, they're living there because they are religions, and they're thinking that this is the Holy Land and the land of God that's given them, and they will not leave them because it's the Holy Land. So they living, the most people that's making the problem and the conflict and pushing not to make agreement is the settlers and the right wing. 99% from them, they living there because of the... It's a holy places, and all of them is with kippot.
Adi?
I'm waving my head no as Muhammad is speaking. I mean, I think that at the end of the day, the most settlers living in the... I mean, there is a very radical fringe that has a lot to do with religion, but at the end of the day, there are secular, completely secular settlements, and the reason that they're there is because the Israeli governments over the years have given them incentives to go and live there. It's cheaper. There definitely are radicals, religious extremists living in the settlements. They are nowhere near the majority. A lot of the settlements, I think it's now, the largest settlements are ultra-Orthodox Jewish settlements. And those, as religious as they are, they have hardly any interest in politics, definitely not in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. They're very segregated, very keeping to their own. At the end of the day, I think the most elements that we're seeing now are not ideological. at all. It is very true that on the fringe, on both sides, and the most vocal, unfortunately, and also slightly getting more powerful, I think, in this current coalition, in the last Knesset, in the last Israeli government, having a little more way and a little more pull, those are indeed religious. But at the end of the day, the consensus, the most people on both sides, religion doesn't play that much of a part.
If she was right, so we agree. We will changing houses. And if the problem of the money, so we changing houses. We'll give them houses in Tel Aviv, Yafa, Haifa, and they will leave. But on the earth, we will found them that fighting with their children, and how we saw it in around Gaza, with their children and their wives and women and this. And it will taking life to get them out. But if she was right and they living because the money, so if I am giving you house, not in the West Bank, on the beach, you will leave it. But in the end, who want to take a settlement outside of the region, he will go to war.
Erez, I'll give you the last word on this before we have to take a break.
I'll make some peace between my two friends.
That's what we're looking for today.
It's a matter of quality. And both of them are right. It's a matter of quality and not quantity. What I mean is that those settlers that are located in the problematic places that you will have to evacuate are the hardliners, the religious hardliners, and they are the problem, not those who came for a standard of living and cheap housing in the occupied territory. So both of them are right.
We do have to take a break. When we come back, we'll get to some more questions from our audience at 860-275-7266. We're joined today by Combatants for Peace. There's a series of events that are happening, a Hartford Seminary lunch talk today at noon. More information at Hartford Seminary's website. An I Wage Peace walk in downtown New Haven coming up this Sunday, October 6th. More information at iwagepeace.org. We'll continue this conversation about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and possible peace in the region. That's coming up next, Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up on tomorrow's show, Dr. Joycelyn Elders may be best known for getting fired by Bill Clinton for comments she made about sex. Ironic. She was in town recently, and we'll talk about her firing, about sex education and health equity. We'll also talk to advice columnist Dan Savage, who's coming to the Connecticut Forum this weekend to talk about being gay. You can join the conversation coming up on the next Where We Live. Today we're talking with Combatants for Peace. They're in our region today for a series of events coming up today and throughout this weekend. We'll put more information on our website, WNPR.org. Aris Crispin is former captain in the Israeli army who joins us, as well as Mohammed Oida, who grew up near the Western Wall in Jerusalem. Bruce Barrett is an activist and founder of iwagepeace.org. And Adi Greenfield also joins us here in studio as well. I want to get to one more quick phone call before we continue with the conversation here. Keith is in Southbury. Hi, Keith.
Oh, how you doing?
Doing well. What's up?
Oh, well, I just wanted to comment. I think I actually got the opportunity just last year to visit Israel and my wife and my two young boys. And it's interesting, we toured a lot with the Israeli tourists, and they talk of how they say the Arabs wish to conquer everything and build mosques on top. So you get this view that, you know, they have to protect everything. And then we specifically took an effort to leave and, like, go on trips where we had Palestinian taxi drivers, and they would take us and show us the wall in Jerusalem and show how they're being oppressed and walls and how hard it is to work around. So then you start seeing their side. And it's, I think, as you said, they really just don't talk to each other. I was amazed myself that most Israelis didn't talk to Palestinians. Palestinians didn't talk to Israelis. And actually, they were very enthusiastic to speak with Americans, both sides. So I kind of agree with the fact that you just got to mix everyone up. And probably at the kids' age, if they just had schools where they all had to go together so they could see both sides of it. And it really isn't religion. I was in the feeling that religion was going to be the core, but religion is like the salt that's put into the wound. There's so many wounds there that before it can heal, someone always throws some salt in there just to keep the wound open.
Well,
it seems like there's that on both sides.
Keith, I think that's a very good report for us, and I think something we, of course, take away from that is the idea that both sides desperately want to talk to Americans about this, which always seems to be what happens. Everyone wants to talk through Americans to Americans. Bruce Barrett, maybe you can talk a bit about what this group, Combatants for Peace, is trying to do and a little bit more about what you're doing throughout this weekend.
We brought Combatants for Peace here to the U.S. because our communities need a way of speaking with each other and hearing each other. Our Muslim, Jewish, and Christian brothers and sisters, excuse me, find this topic very difficult to talk about, and yet we're all here in the United States, and we need to let our government know, let our people know that we want a peace that's pro-Palestinian and pro-Israeli, pro-Israeli and pro-Palestinian, and of course pro-USA. And so far, our communities are divided, so they're either speaking just from the Israeli perspective, wanting to help Israel, or just from the Palestinian perspective and wanting to help Palestine, and they're not thinking win-win. The Combatants for Peace have created a win-win environment. They have successfully found a way for former armed combatants to work, hear each other, and advocate for each other and make changes on the ground. And we want to inspire Americans to do that with each other and bring that to the political community.
Because we just have a few minutes left, why are you a part of this? Why did you join this?
This is a good question, and it's important for me to emphasize. I'm doing this because I'm a patriot. I love my country. I think that the end of occupation, the creation of Palestinian state, is not only for the benefit of the Palestinians, but is vital for the survival of my country, of the state of Israel. Because if this occupation will continue, if the third intifada will start, I'm really worried for our not only morals, but to the very existence of the state of Israel. For some, it's important also that it will be a Jewish state. I respect this. We all know that if the situation will continue, Israel will not be able to be a Jewish state. It will be a one-state solution. So I'm doing it as out of patriotism and love to my country.
Adi, how about you? Why are you doing this?
Doing this here in the States, you mean?
Yes. Why are you involved in this?
I'm involved with this because, as I said, I grew up thinking that I'm a humanist and I'm a liberal. And when I learned more about the situation I was living in, I learned that I needed to do more to become this humanist and liberal that I always thought I was. And I find the Combatants for Peace is the best way to do that. And I'm here now because I think, I mean, traditionally here in the States, faith communities have always been very vocal and very, very involved. And it's very important for us, I think, to sort of show them a way that they might have not thought of before to be involved that would really, really help us get to where we need to go. And we need their involvement, and we want them on our side on this.
Mohammed, for you, why are you involved in this?
To reach peace and liberty without to lose more friends and more years in the jail, and to give our children to feel what we couldn't feel it.
When you talk to people here in the United States, do you believe that they understand this message that you're trying to bring? Do you think that people understand what you're trying to do?
With all I had speak with, I didn't found no one he didn't understand him.
Really? So
yes.
You
if you're speaking with everybody, it's like piece of cake. Like, yes, you should get your state. You should get your freedom. It's enough more than 45 years that we're living in this life, and because of this, I am saying always that our problem is not the nation or people. Our problem is leaders.
Hmm. Well, I want to thank you all very much for being here, and I want to say one more time, there are some events coming up. There's an event coming up at Hartford Seminary today at noon, and you can find out more through Hartford Seminary's website. The I Wage Peace Walk is happening this Sunday. Very quickly, Bruce, just explain to us what this is.
Yeah, we have 35 faith communities, synagogues, mosques, and synagogues coming together, religious and non-religious brothers and sisters, and we're going to walk together from the New Haven Green all the way to the Masjid al-Islam, the mosque, stopping at a church and having brief ceremonies presenting our love and admiration and our respect that we will defend and protect Israelis, Palestinians, Americans, Jews, Muslims in the United States, Israel, and Palestine. So it will be a wonderful walk.
Bruce Barrett, Mohammed Oweda, and Erez Crispin, Adi Greenfield, thank you all so much for being here. I truly appreciate it. I also want to let you know that our friends, the World Affairs Council of Connecticut, are putting on a two-part series, October 23rd and November 5th. Is it now or never, resolving the Israeli and Palestinian conflict? If you want more information, it's ctwac.org. Again, that program put on by the World Affairs Council of Connecticut. Our program produced by Tucker Ives with Heather Brandon and Betsy Kaplan. The senior producer of our show is Katie Tolarski. I'm John Dankowski, and this is Where We Live.